As Matt mentioned, our study was basically in two parts. The first part looked at terrorist financing itself, how it evolved, particularly since 9/11, and the second half of the study focused on what the U.S. had done, what the international community had done, what other governments had done, and then a look at the progress in this area that had been made really since 9/11, as well as outlining some of the challenges that remain. And then I'll offer up after that just a few thoughts, not in too much detail, on our recommendations. First, stepping back, as I mentioned, most of it focuses on the post-9/11 changes, but taking a step back and looking at the pre-9/11 environment, which was a very, very different one. At the time, it's been widely reported that counterterrorism was not a high priority for the government at the time, both in the Clinton administration and into the first year of the Bush administration. And within that, combating terrorist financing was even less of a priority. So I think there was not much of a focus on this issue. It was not much recognition of how important it was. And you did have, in this country, the FBI gathering up a lot of information on what terrorist financing was coming from the U.S. and going outside of the country, but nothing was ever done with this. And so by the time of 9/11, FBI had a lot of information about Hamas fundraising in the U.S., Hezbollah fundraising in the U.S., but there was really no action taken on it. And usually, once the money left the U.S., they lost track of where it was going. And so they knew or suspected that it was going to fund causes that unseemly causes, but there wasn't really a lot of idea as to exactly where it was ending up. there was also one of the issues at the time was that in 1996 there had been a law passed making material support to terrorist organizations a criminal offense. But before 9/11, this law had never been used. There were no prosecutions for material support prior to 9/11. And part of this was the Justice Department kind of waiting for the perfect case. They felt that if they used the statute and then they lost a case, they'd be in really, really bad position. And so the 5 years after this law was passed until 9/11 was kind of waiting and waiting and waiting for the perfect case. The one thing I think that did happen on the counter terrorist financing front that was a positive before 9/11 was actually at the UN, where you had in 1999 the UN passing a resolution declaring that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were terrorist elements. And this was an effort to pressure the Taliban to expel Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan. It didn't work, of course, but I think it actually was an important thing to happen. And after 9/11, when the U.S. was trying to rally the international community, I think the fact that they already had this resolution in place for 2 years that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were terrorist elements made it much easier to rally the international community. And it was also the first time that the U.N. had spoken out on the issue of who was a terrorist. Generally, the U.N. had had these paralyzing debates about terrorists versus freedom fighter, and I think the fact that the U.N. moved on it before 9/11 was a really important step. But the bottom line was, as of 9/11, not that much had been done on this front, and Al-Qaeda's fundraising and terrorist financing activity was fairly secure. You really saw a complete shift in approach after the 9/11 attacks. There was a lot of the information that the FBI had been gathering for years and years prior to 9/11 was suddenly put into action. There were many, many designations by the Treasury Department. You have the Justice Department starting to aggressively use the material support statute. I think there's probably been 70 or 80 cases, if not more, for material support prosecutions. And now the U.S. list of entities that are designated as terrorists is up in the probably close to about 500. So I think it gives a sense of what happened after 9/11. Part of this was possible because of legal changes. There was a new executive order giving the Treasury Department and State Department much more power right after the 9/11 attacks to go after Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. And the Patriot Act also made some other important changes. For example, any money remitter in the U.S. now had to register, otherwise it was a criminal offense if they did not. I think after that initial period where there was kind of a flurry of enforcement activity, you then had a better balance eventually emerge between following the money, which Matt talked about, and enforcement. And I think if you look at the 9/11 Commission and its assessment of it, I think that was one of the reasons why they gave positive marks to the U.S. efforts to combat terrorist financing is that they've done a much better job of focusing on following the money and balancing it with the enforcement actions. and I think the recognition that following the money, as Matt mentioned, is a really important part of this, even if it is generally unseen. You also had a lot of structural changes in this area. A new terrorist financing section at the FBI, a counter-terrorist financing section at Justice Department. The office that we came out of at Treasury was created after the 9/11 attacks, among other things. And I think what happened at Treasury with the growing national security role for a finance ministry also started to occur overseas, where finance ministries, which traditionally had just an economics mission, were all of a sudden being brought into the national security arena, which I think was also a positive step forward. On the international front, in the first few years after 9/11, you had, I think, a lot of positive changes. You had the United Nations, which started to play a role in this area in 1999, really took on an important role and became a big player. I know there's a lot of dismissiveness as to what the UN can do and what the UN does do, particularly in an area like terrorism. But in the first years after 9/11, I think the UN was really a central player in the efforts to combat terrorist financing. The U.S., of course, had its own designation lists, but it was, I think, better for the U.S., and they were able to more effectively utilize this when they could get the UN to UN cover to go after organizations. And the UN list ended up also, and there are now hundreds of entities and individuals on the UN list of al-Qaeda and Taliban members. There were a few other multilateral organizations that also took on combating terrorist financing as one of, as their missions. The Financial Action Task Force, which I think until their recent actions on Iran was completely obscure. Now it's probably just relatively obscure, even though every time I say that, people at Treasury tell me to stop saying that it's obscure, because that's one of their favorite organizations at the Treasury Department. But it's an organization with, on its face, no teeth, but has actually had a pretty big impact in the area of combating terrorist financing. And you had another organization called the Egmont Group, which makes the Financial Action Task Force look well-known. And they have also played a role, particularly in joining the financial intelligence units around the world together and to try to increase information sharing among the financial intelligence units. You also, on the positive side of things that happened after 9/11, the private sector, I think, got a lot more engaged. And you had, for example, the spending that private sector put into compliance issues relating to terrorist financing increased by about 60% is the figure we saw between 2004 and 2007. And what I think was even more surprising, and that's obviously under government pressure, but I think what was more surprising to us was there was almost no complaint from the private sector on this. I think the figures that I saw were about 93% of the companies felt that the burden was about right. So even as they were being asked to do more, they were happily doing more generally. And I think one reason is you've got the senior officials of the FBI at Treasury going around and talking about the suspicious activity reports that these banks are filing and the usefulness in criminal investigations and in terrorist investigations. And the FBI said that about 42% of their investigations, that there was a relevant suspicious activity report that had been filed. So I think when the private sector hears things like that, they realize that the reports are not for naught. Going to the more regional issues, the Europeans also took a number of steps forward in this period after 9/11, putting in place their two terrorism lists, one for al-Qaeda and Taliban, and one for other terrorist groups. And the Europeans also put a number of additional requirements in the private sector, and they also created some other positions and investigative bodies to focus on financial crime and terrorist financing. And I mentioned that the finance ministry is increasing their role. The British are a particularly good example of that. And they actually gave Gordon Brown, when he was the chancellor, made it one of his priorities to turn HM Treasury into more of a national security arm, and adding something called the Terrorist Asset Freezing Unit at the HM Treasury. This is probably the closest thing to the U.S. model that's out there now. Moving on to the Gulf. The Gulf, there were also many improvements in the period after 9/11. And part of this was that Bahrain, the UAE, Qatar, were trying to establish themselves as real international financial centers. And I think there was the recognition that the only way they could do this is if they were basically terrorism-free. And there was real concern, I think, that if there was a terrorist attack, if there were real credible allegations of terrorist financing in those countries, it would really hurt their attempts to draw in international capital and could put their efforts at risk. And a lot of the Gulf countries put in place real regulatory regimes, the ones dictated by the Financial Action Task Force, to address this and to show that they were serious about combating terrorist financing. The UAE was a particularly interesting case. A lot came out after 9/11 about the way the 9/11 hijackers used UAE as a transit point, where they were getting money there, transiting to the United States, etc. And I think they recognized, the UAE in particular, recognized that they had to do something about their reputation. And so one of the issues that they actually have taken on, which I think is obviously a very sensitive issue, is the issue of hawalas. And you go to, I'll talk about this a little more, but you go to other Gulf countries that where they will say to you, we do not have any hawalas, and we can talk about the evidence to the contrary, but the UAE was quite open about the fact that they had many, many hawalas, and they decided they wanted to try to register them. And so they were trying to basically bring them out of the open with some promises made about that they wouldn't go after them, that they would that they were just trying to provide guidance. And at the time that we were there, I think about 350 hawalas had reached out to the government in the UAE and started the registration process. I think there were some other interesting things that the Gulf countries did as well. Bahrain, we heard about some of what they were trying to do with charities and charities operating overseas. And one of the things that they've done in cases where there are humanitarian disasters, they would actually set up a cabinet committee to control the charitable funds going to wherever it would be. And I think that something that they did, which I haven't seen elsewhere, was, for example, in the earthquake in Kashmir, where they set up a committee to send funds out there, and they actually had oversight teams from the government go out to Kashmir and see whether the funds were actually ending up where they were supposed to be ending up. So it was, and this has been a real problem in the Gulf, was trying to tell some of the Gulf countries that you should be responsible not only for what is occurring in your country itself, but for funds emanating outwards and where they go. And so Bahrain, the people we spoke to, I think recognized that and were trying to take steps to to address that. The Saudis as well have made some progress in this area, including taking some rather far-reaching steps, like taking the collection boxes out of mosques and trying to prohibit charities from sending funds out of the kingdom, although not entirely successful. And I think one significant thing was back in October 2007, when the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia made a comment about being careful where your funds are going. And this was, I think, a pretty important statement for the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia to be basically cautioning people to be careful about where their charity is going. Kuwait, I think, has made some progress as well. For example, setting up some monitoring teams during Ramadan to try to, again, make sure that the funds were not being diverted, and also prohibiting charitable donations in cash. I think, though, despite this, what we found during our study was, despite these areas of progress that I've talked about, there's a lot of problems that still remain. One is, I mentioned the progress the UN has made in establishing itself as a player in this region. That has really started to slip over the last few years. The nominations to the UN's, what's called the 1267 list of Al-Qaeda and Taliban members, has really dropped. And we spoke to the head of the monitoring team, who called the current list creaky, because it's now full of things like dead people and very, very vague names that are basically useless to the financial sector, useless to others. And there's been little effort to basically clean up this list. And so I think as the list has lost a little credibility, I think countries, the number of nominations have dropped, and I think the general regard for the list has dropped as well. And I think also you've seen countries not enforce the sanctions that are required, or even some of them publicly. For example, one of the people on the list is a guy named Yasin Kadi, who happens to be friendly with some of the Turkish leadership. And the Turkish leadership, even though he was on this list, they've made very, very positive comments about him, saying things like he's a charitable person, and that, quote, being on the list doesn't mean you're guilty. And when you're able to have governmental leaders make comments like that with really no consequences, nothing ever happens when they say something like that, and they clearly aren't enforcing the sanctions, I think it really starts to undermine the whole system. In Europe as well, I think there's been some real problems as well. I think the terrorist list that I mentioned, the two European terrorist lists for the Al-Qaeda members and for the other groups, are also under fire now. There's been a few rulings by the European Court of Justice which have called into question basically the lack of due process, the lack of transparency in the systems. And I think there's real concern. The European Union is trying to figure out how to respond to the latest court judgment right now, but there has been real concern that this could be kind of the beginning of the end for these various terrorism lists. And you also have, and the UK also suffered in the MEK case, suffered a defeat before its appellate court on its MEK designation, which was actually much more substantive in nature. The court reviewed the entire package and said, basically, we don't think they're terrorists anymore. So you've got that going on in Europe, which is targeting not only the European list, but the UN list as well. And you've also got really mixed implementation in Europe. You've got some countries that I think take their obligations to freeze the assets, to ban the travel, etc., of people on these lists seriously, and some that really don't. One British lawyer that I interviewed for this project was talking about the differences in how the countries interpret it. He was talking about how for suspicious activity reporting, the UK government issued 200 pages of directives as to how you go about implementing this, and the Spanish government issued 2 pages. So, I mean, he said his view was that some countries interpret this seriously and others regard them as polite suggestions. And unfortunately, the Commission doesn't have much power to do much about this. A country is not following through on and really aggressively implementing the terrorist financing requirements. Not much happens. And as a result, I think most of the asset freezing and most of the action on this really takes place among a few countries, such as the UK, France, and a few others. In the Persian Gulf, I think, as I mentioned, there has been progress, but there's still some problems. One of the issues is that while there's regulatory regimes in place in a lot of these countries now, and I can't tell you the number of times that Matt and I would be in a meeting in the Gulf, and we'd be handed a CD, a book, whatever it would be, with the rules, the regulations, the everything you'd have in place in response to the Financial Action Task Force regulations. But then you'd ask, okay, well, this particular power, how often has it been used? Well, not yet. And how about this power? Well, not yet. So I think that really is one of the basic problems that we found in the Gulf, is that there's a lot on paper, there's a lot that meets international standards, and not always a lot of follow-through. And the feeling among some of the U.S. officials we talk to, follow the region closely and work in the region, is that there's a lot of countries that on the surface look like they have this well under control, and then when you dig a little deeper, it's not quite so great. And one of the examples we heard was in Dubai, which is obviously one of the major international financial centers, where they had 2 people working financial crime for the entire Dubai Police Department, which obviously isn't sufficient. We also heard from some of the people in the private sector particularly. These were often expats who were reporting in to nationals from these countries. And there was a lot of frustration there on their ability to really do their compliance job well. And they felt like there were real limitations in what they were allowed to ask. For example, one of the people complained to us that, let's say he was asked to open an account for a Bahraini national, and he wanted the Bahraini national's wife's passport information as part of this process. That was a culturally insensitive thing for him to ask. Why would he need somebody's wife's passport information? And he was not. And if he would go up the chain of the bank, it would always be a Bahraini at the top, and he would be unable to proceed with this. And so there were some real frustrations among the compliance people that there were limitations on what they could do. And one of the other issues was with the source of funds, particularly when it came to Saudi funds. You had a lot of Saudi money flowing around the region, and the compliance people would say, okay, well, to the Saudi client, we want to know, where did you get this money? And the answer would come back from the person at the top of the bank saying, this is a well-respected family, basically back off. And so those were kind of issues that we heard, and complaints mostly from compliance people in the Gulf. And these are also in many cases, cash-based cultures. And we heard from DHS officials about their attempts to press the Saudis to more effectively crack down on that cash-based culture. They were trying to get the Saudis to put in place a regulation governing how much money you could take in and out of the kingdom. And it took a while to get there, and finally they convinced the Saudis, okay, we'll put that in place. They put a regulation in place that you now had to declare money, you're taking in and out over a certain amount. But then the Saudis actually didn't create a form that you would actually fill out. And so then battle two was to try to get the Saudis to actually create the form that you'd have to fill out. And that even once that form is in place, it's still, their concern was that they're still not the prominent people coming through. There's no way they're going to ask them those kind of questions. And finally, Kuwait. I think Kuwait was described to us by a few people in terms of terrorist financing as what Saudi Arabia was prior to 2003, when the Saudis were attacked at home for the first time in May 2003. And at that point, the Saudis got a lot more aggressive, particularly in cracking down on operational cells and in things that they deemed a threat to the kingdom. But that the Kuwaitis still don't view this really as an existential threat to them, and so there's real limits as to what they are willing to do. In terms of some of the other kind of broad-based problems, and then I'll wrap up with a little bit on recommendations. As Matt mentioned, the shift away from formal financial institutions, though there obviously still are some formal financial institutions used, to more technologically sophisticated ways of transferring money, like cell phones, as well as less technologically sophisticated things like cash couriers and hawalas. Both of those have made law enforcement and intelligence's job more difficult. It's obviously harder to track money when it's going through those cash couriers. But of course, there are certain advantages. Cash couriers get greedy; they can get caught. But overall, it's certainly made. I think it's a sign of success that we're having some impact on the way terrorists raise and move money. But it's also our own success has made our job more difficult at times. One thing that I mentioned also, which I think in the Gulf, which I think is a problem more broadly, there's a lot of focus on kind of this rules-based approach. And the positive side of this is you can walk into a meeting in Europe, a meeting in the Gulf, it doesn't even matter where in the world. It can be with a banker, with a government official, and they can cite to you what the Financial Action Task Force's nine special recommendations are on terrorist financing. And they can tell you what steps they've taken to comply with them, et cetera. And that's impressive, and it's actually a credit to the U.S. Treasury, it's a credit to the Financial Action Task Force that you can do that. But the downside of it, as I mentioned, is that the follow-through often becomes much less of a focus. And the State Department said in a recent report that, quote, too many countries are getting caught up in the process and losing sight of the objective. And in some cases, people are less focused on, are we actually stopping terrorist financing? Do we actually know what the threats are here? And are we taking the right steps to stop them? And much more on, okay, here's the rule book we can hold up and demonstrate to everyone that we're following through on our international organizations, on our international obligations. And I think that that's a real problem. I mentioned also the private sector and the positives that in terms of the increased funds on compliance and the increased focus on compliance by the private sector. But there is also frustration. And there's a real frustration with the governments, not just in the U.S., but more broadly, that the governments basically aren't telling them what to look for. That they will, again, tell them, okay, here are the rules you have to put in place, but do they know whether they're catching anything? Do they know whether they're looking at the right places? The feeling is often no. And one of the British lawyers that I interviewed for this, I thought, his complaint was he has filled out so many suspicious activity reports over the years, and just felt like they're going off into this black hole. And he has no idea, is anyone from the government reading them, not reading them? Do they make a difference? And he actually decided he had to take matters into his own hand. And he decided to create his own form. And he added categories for urgent, extremely urgent, and then would mark those off on the ones that he thought were actually really important. He said he still didn't hear back from the government, but it made him feel better about the whole process. So. But I think that is a problem broadly is among the private sector people that we spoke to. Matt already spoke about charities, so I won't delve into that too deeply. But one of the issues, and the Financial Action Task Force has recognized this, is that charities in general are subject to less kind of regulation and less oversight than banks or other companies. And so terrorist organizations have often taken advantage of this. And there's also reluctance by a lot of countries to take on this issue. And in Europe, for example, even getting to the point where you could make charities register is not somewhere most European countries are willing to go. And for example, in a few European countries where it's actually they said to us that it raises constitutional issues, even the idea of making charities register, let alone trying to figure out how to regulate them. So I think it really gives a sense of how touchy and sensitive this area is, despite its overall importance. I'll touch very briefly on a few of the recommendations, and then we can talk about it more in the Q&A. One of the issues that we talk about that I think will be interesting is I think there's a lot of skepticism out there about this area. I think there's a lot of skepticism as to, particularly as terrorist attacks. I mean, first you look at the 9/11 attacks, which cost about $500,000, and then you look at some of the attacks since then, which have been even cheaper. And I think as these figures keep on coming out about how cheap terrorist attacks are to carry out, there's growing skepticism about why are we even doing this? If an attack only costs $20,000 to carry out, what's even the point of this? Are we going to make any impact? And so I think making sure that governments, for some of the reasons that Matt talked about earlier, that governments understand that this is actually, obviously it's not going to solve everything, but why it should be an important part of the overall counterterrorism strategy, and why it does have to be one of the tools you rely on, I think is really one of the priorities for the next administration. A few other thoughts on this. One is going to be, I think the next administration is also going to have to look carefully at the terrorism lists that are out there. As I mentioned, there's concern, particularly at the UN, that the entire system is on the verge of falling apart. And I think as the next administration, which will undoubtedly look to kind of to build international cooperation on this issue, I think the lists are going to be regarded as an important source of this. The U.S. unilateral lists obviously have their power and there's some benefits to this, but I think the next administration is really going to be looking to the UN and the Europeans to join them in this effort and figure out a way to make sure that these lists don't fall apart. I think will be a priority for the next administration.